Okay, so I'm going to talk about disk winds and active galactic nuclei. And as you could tell from Nahum's very nice talk, the outflows in these objects are enormously complicated. And I'll just take a step back and look at these from a very simple perspective and mostly summarize a lot of the work that I did with Norm Murray, most of it taking place before 1999. Now, in order to satisfy the mandate of this conference to discuss what sort of progress has been made since then, I'm going to talk a lot about some of the numerical simulations that Daniel Proger has done along with Tim Kalman and Jim Stone, which has helped perhaps validate some of the theories that I put forth with Norm and Mark Boyd and Scott Grossman. Also like to acknowledge some conversations I've had with Nahum recently and also Dave Turncheck during the course of this meeting, which has helped me organize my thoughts in presenting this talk. So first of all, some motivation, at least for this particular model. As Nahum has discussed, about 10% of optically selected radio quiet QSOs have these broad absorption line features. And in these 10%, you see these broad absorption lines in lines such as Lyman alpha and high ionization lines like carbon 4, nitrogen 5, oxygen 6, et cetera. And the width of these lines are typically greater than or equal to about 5,000 kilometers per second. Additionally, amongst these broad absorption line QSOs, one also sees about 15% of them which have low ionization absorption in ions like magnesium 2 and aluminum 3. And in addition, there seem to be a range of velocities at which this absorption sets in. Here's sort of a menagerie of different carbon 4 broad absorption line profiles. And you can see for objects like PHL5200, the absorption sets in at nearly zero velocity. Whereas for objects like this one here, there's a large detachment velocity at which the absorption sets in of order 10 to the 4 kilometers per second. In addition, aside from the fact that you see these broad absorption lines in the UV spectra, if you look at the spectra of non-BL QSOs and BL QSOs, they appear quite similar, aside from the fact that there's broad absorption lines in one of these classes of objects. And here's a study done by Wyman et al. Back in 1991, where they formed the composite spectrum of non-BL QSOs and high ionization BL QSOs, and also these low ionization BL QSOs. And what one sees is that if you plot these guys on top of one another, normalizing them to some frequency at about 2500, that the shape of the emission lines and the UV continuum pretty well match up together for these high ionization guys and the non-BL QSOs. The low ionization BL QSOs have a systematically redder underlying continuum spectrum, which probably is indicative of dust absorption in these objects. Okay, so given these observational facts, that sort of motivates a model along with the fact that one tends to see these absorption profiles looking very similar to P Cygni profiles in O stars. And so given the unified model of AGNs, the model which we proposed, Norm Murray and I and others, was that for the non-BL QSOs, you're looking down on an accretion disk, and here's some central continuum source down here, and that there's a wind emerging from the disk. And for lines of sight which intersect this wind, you see the absorption. And it's because the wind is outflowing, the absorption is blue shifted. And for different angles or inclinations of lines of sight, you see different detachment velocities because you intersect this innermost streamline at different angles and therefore different velocities. And you also get different covering fractions for the high ionization via QSOs of order 10%, which depends on this opening angle covering factor. And for the low ionization BL QSOs, which you expect to see in the denser parts of the wind, along inclinations closer to the disk, you'll get a smaller covering factor. Okay, so that's just a sort of simple motivation for the model. As you saw from Nahum's talk, the absorption features that you see are enormously complicated, probably can't be modeled adequately in sort of a smooth outflow like you see in O stars. But let's put that aside for a moment and just talk about the mechanisms which are likely to take place to drive these winds from the surfaces of the disk. And so there are sort of two mechanisms that I can envision which would be relevant for these objects. The first one is the magnetocentrifugal acceleration mechanism proposed by Blanford and Payne. And in this context, this model was originally proposed to describe jets from disk around black holes. And in this case, what you have is a colloidal field anchored to the disk, such that any material which moves along, which is constrained to move along the field lines, if it's largely colloidal, will have a constant, will be constrained to have a constant angular velocity. So that if the inclination of the field line relative to the disk normal is greater than 30 degrees, you'll get this material flung out like a bead on a wire, and you'll have centrifugal acceleration. Okay? And Blanford and Payne, along with some other people, have constructed self-similar solutions in this model, mostly in the context of explaining jets and AGNs and other objects like that. However, these authors here, Emmering, Blanford, and Schlossman, and Botroff et al., have recently applied this wind model to explain the broad emission line region in objects like NGC 5548, the Type 1 Seyfert. And the question is whether outflows like this have any relevance for explaining the broad absorption line regions in these objects. The other acceleration mechanism, which is probably relevant for driving outflows from disks, is just radiative acceleration. And that's sort of a natural way of obtaining momentum flux just from the central luminosity, from the luminosity of the central source. And there are sort of four different ways of accelerating things via radiative acceleration. One is just simply electron scattering. However, if the Eddington ratio is less than one, it's unlikely that this will be a principal means of accelerating material from the surface of the disk. However, Roger Blanford brought up a couple of days ago the possibility that BEL QSOs could have Eddington ratios greater than one, and I'll comment on that towards the end of the talk if I have some time. Of course, there are other sources of opacity. One is dust, but for the class of solutions I'll be talking about, the temperature of the disk will be greater than the sublimation temperature, so it's unlikely that there will be significant opacity due to dust in order to drive the wind that way. Another source of opacity is bound-free absorption. And Shalush and Metzer have looked at this in the context of warm absorbers. But as it turns out, the sorts of acceleration you get from this mechanism is much less than the acceleration you get from line driving, which is the mechanism proposed by Cass, Rabbit, and Klein to explain the P-Cygni profiles in OSTARs. Okay, and that's the mechanism which I'll spend most of my time talking about. Okay, so, okay, thank you. Okay, so just to briefly review line acceleration. This is a theory which has been well developed over the course of the last 25 years, but I'm going to talk about a lot of the terms involved in these formulas, so it's useful to go over them just to remind you how this all works. So the acceleration due to the lines is just summing up the contribution of the momentum flux captured by any given line. So this combination of terms here is just the radiation pressure for a line of a given optical depth. And this delta nu is just the width of this line, the thermal width over C times the frequency of the line. So this is the radiation pressure. To get an acceleration, you have to divide by the mass column density, and that's just this combination of terms. And you can see from this expression that if the line is optically thick, as you would expect, you trap all the radiation, and the acceleration doesn't depend on the opacity of the individual line. However, if the line is optically thin, then it's just proportional to the opacity. And it's useful in discussing these this acceleration mechanism to define this optical depth parameter, little t. In a static atmosphere, this little t is just the Thomson depth through the atmosphere. In an expanding atmosphere, it's simply the thickness of a Sobolev surface for radiation which is passing through this expanding atmosphere. And so what's going on here is that the thickness of the Sobolev surface is just the thickness of the material which is in resonance with a line of a particular frequency. So once the material is expanded out of resonance with the line, there's no more contribution from that line to the radiative acceleration. Okay. And so using this definition, you can just plug it in to the equation here. And you form this quantity, which is called the force multiplier. And the reason why this quantity is convenient is it just gives you the ratio of the radiative acceleration to the acceleration you expect just from electron scattering. Okay. And so this force multiplier is just these terms in the square bracket here. And you can see in the limit that all these lines are optically thick, this force multiplier will just be proportional to 1 over t. And that will be the case if you consider, say, just resonance lines and calculating the contribution to the acceleration. If you include all the subordinate lines as well, you'll get an index which is generally less than 1, and which is generally found to be about 0.5 or 0.6. Now, if the lines are optically thin, and that'll happen in the limit that you have very small values of t, then you'll see from this term here that this optical depth parameter drops out of the problem, and you just get a factor which is proportional to the opacity of the line, and that the opacity of the line kappa. And kappa, in turn, is just proportional to the oscillator strength of each of these lines. So essentially what you get as an upper limit, if you take this term for the momentum flux outside of the summation, you get a summation over oscillator strengths, and you can invoke the oscillator strength sum rule for each of these lines in order to get an upper limit for the maximum value of what the force multiplier is. And for these, for O stars and for winds and AGNs, it turns out that the maximum value is of order 10 to the 3, okay, for the radiative acceleration at small optical depths. Okay, so this is all well and good for O stars. For AGNs, the spectral energy distribution is substantially different, and you're going to expect to see a lot of ionization of the lines of the atoms in the outflow, and that's going to affect what the effect of radiative acceleration due to line driving turns out to be. So just to remind you, the ionization parameter is just the ratio of the number of ionizing photons above 1 Rydberg to the number density of hydrogen atoms. There's an alternative definition which differs from this one by factors of order unity for certain reasonable spectral energy distributions, which is just the luminosity above 1 Rydberg divided by 4 pi r squared divided by the number density of hydrogen atoms. And that's typically denoted by this C symbol here. So in O stars, because they don't have the soft X-rays and the high ionizing flux, you can attain rather high ionization parameters and still drive an outflow. However, in AGNs, because they have large amounts of soft X-ray flux and X-ray continuum, which ionize these atoms particularly above the helium transition at 54 eV, you generally require an ionization parameter of less than about 0.1 to 1 for the bare continuum of the spectral energy distribution, which is seen from these AGNs. So that gives you a means, given these formula, of constraining the luminosity and the density and the distance from the central object of this gas, which is being radiatively accelerated by this line force. And so in order to avoid over-ionizing the lines so that you actually get radiative acceleration due to line driving, there are a couple of different solutions, which you can see just from examining this equation. You can place the source, you can place the material far away from the source, essentially making this value rather small. But the problem is, at least for broad emission lines, for reverberation mapping results for broad emission lines in type 1 Tfer galaxies like NGC 5548, the broad line region is of order 10 to 16 centimeters or less, which means that you can't really place this material far enough away if it's being radiatively accelerated. On the other hand, you can make the density very large. You can make it of order 10 to the 10. But if you do this, that implies a small size scale for the material which is doing the absorbing. Basically, the column densities, which you can infer just from the UV lines, which would be of order 10 to the 20, as you saw from the Hooms talk, or 10 to the 23 if you look at the warm absorbers, and divide that by the density you posit in order to satisfy this ionization constraint, you'll see a link scale for the absorber of 10 to the 13 centimeters, which is rather small. And this implies small filling factors for this material which is doing the absorbing. The filling factor is less than of order 10 to the minus 4, which is just the ratio of the size scale that you posit for this link scale here and this absorber link scale. And so that means that if you have small filling factors in these small clouds, which have temperatures of order 10 to the 4 Kelvin, they're going to want to expand. And they're going to do so on a time scale which is much shorter than you would expect to see from observations of these objects. And so you run into a confinement problem. You have to keep these clouds coherent on short enough time scales. And there have been several suggestions on how to do that. One way to do that is to embed the clouds in hot gas, but this requires temperatures of order 10 to the 8 Kelvin, which exceeds the constant temperature for typical spectral energy distributions you see from AGNs. So this mechanism doesn't seem to work. Another way you could confine these clouds is by magnetic pressure. And in that case, you seem to require a magnetic field of about a Gauss. And this may have some relevance for driving winds if the absorbers are these small clouds in these sort of magnetocentrifugal wind models, which I mentioned before. Alternatively, another way of solving the ionization problem is by just filtering out the offending X-rays. Okay, so what I'm showing here are a series of photoionization models for different, showing the transmitted spectrum for different column densities through which the incident continuum is being transmitted. So I'm showing here two different bare AGN continuum which have been proposed. This continuum here, which is the dashed line, for which I didn't actually do the ionization calculations, is the Matthews-Ferlin spectral energy distribution. And the shape of the spectral energy distribution, particularly here in the soft X-rays, has been inferred largely by the requirement that the equivalent width of the helium-2 line in the UV be produced by photoionization. And that's the requirement that you have sufficient flux at the helium ionization edge in order to produce those lines. And so this Matthews-Ferlin spectrum, if you normalize it to the part of the spectrum you can actually observe, has a large fraction of soft photons, which would provide ionization. By contrast, this solid line here is a spectral energy distribution derived by Zheng and also by Lior directly from observations of continuum spectra of AGN. And in this case, you see a strong deficit relative to the Matthews-Ferlin spectrum of the ionizing flux at about 54 EV. Okay, and I'll talk about how to resolve the issue of the helium-2 UV equivalent width a little bit later in the talk. Okay, so but anyways, the point of all this was to show that if you increase the column density from say 10 to the 22 to 10 to the 23 up to 10 to the 24, you can effectively filter out many of these ionizing photons. And if you do that, what you'll be left with is a spectrum here shown in red for 10 to the 24, which looks very similar to this blue curve here. And this blue curve here is just a black body spectrum for an object with a temperature typical of an O star. Okay, so you can see that you can filter out these ionizing photons and recover a spectral energy distribution similar to the case for an O star. And so sort of the observational justification for applying all this large column density of filtering is the fact that broad absorption line QSOs are generally seen to be X-ray quiet. And that can arise in one of two ways. They could be intrinsically X-ray quiet and have alpha to OX ratios, which tell you that there just aren't any X-rays down here, that the spectral energy distribution is actually dissimilar from what was inferred by Zheng and Lior for optically selected radio quiet quasars. Or it could be that these guys are absorbed. And recent Chandra observations by Paul Green and long integrations by ASCA described by Smith and Mather show that, in fact, that there are column densities of order 10 to the 23 to 10 to the 24, which are required to filter out these ionizing photons. So there actually are these huge column densities. The question is whether these column densities are where you want them to be in order to provide the line driving to drive winds from this. Down here, what I'm showing is the effect of X-ray absorption on the force multiplier given these spectral energy distributions. So I've taken these same calculations and computed that summation over the resonance and subordinate lines and calculated what the force multiplier is as a function of ionization parameter and also for, say, a nominal optical depth of 10 to the minus 4. You can look at different optical depths and you see similar sorts of curves. So what you see is if you illuminate some material with this bare AGN continuum with all these ionizing photons in here, the force multiplier, as you go up to higher and higher ionization parameters, gets suppressed by a large amount. You're down to about 10 to the minus 2 down here. However, as you build up the column, you filter out these ionizing photons, and you can recover a lot of the force multiplier, in fact, almost all of it, all the way up to ionization parameters of 10 to 100 for column densities of 10 to the 24. Okay. Okay. Okay, so the proposition is that in accretion disk winds that you have these large ionizing, or these large column densities to filter out the ionizing photons. So we're going to proceed for now on the assumption that this filtering does take place, and I'll just discuss some of the dynamics of disk winds just to give you an idea for what the velocity and length scales are relevant for this problem. Okay, so and this is the work that I did with Norm Murray all the way back in 1995. So for disk winds, you can write down a radial equation describing the outflow, which is very similar to the equation Kastrabad and Klein wrote down for O stars. Okay, the principal difference between the equation which is used for O stars is that the wind originates from a disk, and there's this centrifugal support term which modifies the dynamics. Okay, and it modifies the dynamics in the following way. You can still model the solution or the velocity profile for this radial equation with an equation of this form, where you have Vr is just equal to some terminal velocity at infinity times this factor here with this exponent beta. And it turns out that this this terminal velocity in typical cases in the disk wind, as it is for O stars, is typically going to be of order a few times the escape velocity at the foot point radius, Rf, at which the wind originates. Okay, and so with the inclusion of the centrifugal support term, this index beta is going to have this form, 1 plus alpha over 2 alpha. And so if alpha is 0.6, that means its exponent is about 1.3 or 1. In the O star case, you don't have the centrifugal support term, and you get an exponent of 0.5. Okay? And the fact that this exponent is bigger in the disk wind case than it is in the O star case is just a reflection of the fact that the acceleration at the critical point, or really beyond the sonic point of this wind, is set by the effective gravity. So because you have rotational support in a disk, the effective gravity is less. And this wind with this exponent, if you calculate the gradients of the radial velocity, accelerates slower at the outset. And that's because the effective gravity is lower because of this rotational support. And one fact that I'm going to draw upon in the next few view graphs is even though the disk wind accelerates at a slower rate near the foot points of the wind, you still get large or relatively large radial gradients along the wind streamline. If you calculate this radial gradient just given this formula, you find that it's of order V infinity over Rf at the foot point of the wind. Okay, and this, of course, since V infinity is of order V escape, is just going to be of order V phi over R. And that's the Keplerian shear, the azimuthal shear in a Keplerian disk. And as I'll discuss in the next few view graphs, that's going to be relevant for the application of this disk wind model to the formation of broad emission lines in these objects. Okay, but I'll get to that in a second. So getting back to this wind equation, you can solve this wind equation, and it'll pass through a critical point and all that stuff. And you'll find an eigenvalue for the mass loss rate in the wind. And the eigenvalue that we find is about 10 to the 26 grams per second for a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole, depending on the Eddington ratio as a power of 1 over alpha. And so that means that if you integrate along one of these radial field lines, given this mass loss rate, you'll obtain column densities of order 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 24, which is right where you want to be if the broad absorption lines are due to viewing down streamlines of this radially accelerated disk wind. Okay. Now, in order to solve the disk wind problem for AGNs, we have to make some simplifications of the Navier-Stokes equations. In particular, we had to write down an approximate solution in the radial direction and decouple it from the similar equation occurring in the theta direction. And in the context of this very approximate solution, we were able to recover this 10% covering factor that you saw that is required for the opening angle of this wind, subject to the constraint that the maximum ionization parameter you could sustain at the innermost radius of this wind was about 10. Okay, so we were able to recover this covering factor. And we also attempted to compute in determining the force multiplier in this equation self-consistently, thanks, using a line list, this force multiplier self-consistently using a photoionization code, calculating the distribution of various ions in this line. But we still had to posit that there was an additional filtering column to filter out the ionizing X-rays. And that was one of the central uncertainties, along with the fact that we were considering these decoupled models for solving the wind equations here. So that means that, and the explanation that we posited for this filtering gas was that there was perhaps some gas interior to the wind inner radius, which was entrained along, which we called this hitchhiking gas. Alternatively, we posited that there could be some wind driven from the disk. When it got to sufficiently high velocities, the density would go down, and the ionization parameter would go up, and the line driving would stop. And if this wind had not reached the escape velocity, this wind would fall back down to the disk. Or perhaps that there was some absorption due to the disk atmosphere interior to the innermost radius of this wind. So in order to address all these problems, one would require two-dimensional hydrodynamic simulations to see if any of these scenarios would hold up. So let me actually turn to those simulations right now, which is work that Daniel Proga has been doing in a number of different contexts. But for our purposes now, the work that he's done on AGNs is the most relevant. So, so this is work by Proga, Stone, and Kalman. And these guys use the Zeus 2D code to integrate the fluid equations, the full fluid equations, none of the approximations that we used. One of the principal difficulties in doing this sort of work is you have to work out an efficient quadrature scheme to calculate the contribution to the radiative driving from this disk. Because the source of radiation is distributed over a large range of radii on the surface of the disk, in addition to having a source of central X-ray emission, you have to integrate in two dimensions the forces which come from vertical driving from beneath the outflow, and also from the central source. And so they worked out an efficient quadrature scheme to do that. And of course, the whole point of this was to see if you could include the effects of ionization and shielding on the line acceleration in order to provide the remaining acceleration to drive these winds to large radii. And so the point of this particular calculation, and Daniel is here so you can ask him about some of the details of that, was to show that it was dynamically possible to shield the wind in such a way to drive these outflows. Okay? But unfortunately, writing a code which does the 2D hydrodynamics and does the photoionization calculations to determine what the effective X-ray opacity is a very difficult problem. So to get around that, they just posited, or they set the X-ray opacity to be a parameter which they could adjust, subject to some constraints on the level of ionization in the wind. So for ionization parameters less than, say, 10 to the 5, they posited a rather large X-ray opacity. And for very large ionization parameters, they posited sort of the minimum value of the X-ray opacity given by electron scattering. And then they calculated the ionization parameter for the wind itself by considering the bare ionization, unabsorbed ionization parameter, decreased by the optical depth due to this opacity. And then they used these results of Stevens and Kalman, who have calculated the force multiplier for different ionization levels. And as you can see, as the ionization level goes up, the force multiplier goes down. And so that's the effect that they wanted to check. So as it turns out, if the X-ray opacity is sufficiently large, one can, in fact, drive a wind from a disk. Okay. And so what I show here is a plot of density, which Daniel has provided me with, which shows one instance of his wind solution. And as you can see, the flow is actually rather complex. And that has to do with the fact that most of the flow lines are originating from the surface of the disk are being driven vertically upwards. And only after they've reached a certain height, in fact, only after they've reached this opening angle here, do these flow lines start to go out radially. And it seems to me, from talking to Daniel, that the nature of the instability, which causes all this sort of turbulent motion in here, has to do with the fact that as you drive material up from the wind, the effect, the vertical component of gravity that you see increases with z. And so that means as you drive material upwards, this material wants to fall back down. and that's going to cause time-dependent behavior in this disk wind. Okay? But nonetheless, despite some of the uncertainties in this model and the fact that it's non-stationary, you can find, Daniel does find that that at the inner edge of this wind, there is actually a sort of failed wind which gets launched from the inner edge of this disk, becomes over-ionized, and sort of falls back down, like we proposed. And that, that if the X-ray opacities are sufficiently large, you can get sufficient column to filter out the ionizing flux from the central continuum, which will allow the UV flux still to pass through this wind and drive these lines to have radial field lines. One of the features of Daniel's calculations are these episodic ejections, which you see here. This density contrast for this particular blob of material is about 10 to the 2. And that may have some relevance, as Nahum intimated, for producing the complex absorption structures you see in the broad absorption line quasars. And Daniel has also provided sort of an interesting analysis of the circumstances under which you would expect to see winds driven from disks, generally speaking. And the idea is the following. So what he's plotted here is as a function of Eddington ratio for a number of different sorts of objects. These two guys here are for X-ray binaries, the 10 to the solar mass black hole here, a 1.4 solar mass neutron star. And so what's being calculated here as a function of Eddington ratio is the fraction of that Eddington ratio, which consists of UV flux. So basically, he's taking sort of standard disks around various different objects. This is an AGN here with a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. This is a young stellar object with a small 0.2 solar mass central object. And this is a white dwarf with a 0.6 solar mass central object. And it's known, in fact, that white dwarfs do have winds driven from disks. And so the idea is that the UV Eddington ratio has to be at least as large as the maximum force, one over the maximum force multiplier to drive a wind from the disk. If it's anything less than this, as it would be for X-ray binaries, then you wouldn't be able to drive a wind because you wouldn't have sufficient impetus from the line drive to drive the wind to begin with. So you can see for objects like AGNs, there is, in fact, sufficient UV flux in order to drive a wind off of these objects. Of course, the problem is that if you have ionization in these objects, this limit, this 1 over the maximum force multiplier is going to be driven up towards 1. And you could run into some problems at values of this Eddington ratio of 10 to the 2 or so. OK. So one of the problems, I guess, is making this connection between the disk wind and the broad absorption line region. Okay. Now, as Nahum has mentioned, there's a problem with time scales. And that's because if you look at the location of the broad absorption line features, they appear to be stable over very, very long time scales, greater than or equal to 10 years, even though the optical depths do seem to change. And this implies, just from simple arguments, that these absorption features have to be produced relatively far from the central source. In addition, you see this very complex trough structure. Okay? And so, as you've seen from the Nahum's talk, one way of accommodating this very complex trough structure is to postulate that you have partial covering in velocity space and that the wind actually originates from certain parts of the disk along these flow sheets. And as Roger has pointed out, in order to have stability in terms of the structure, these flow sheets have to be, by and large, be azimuthally symmetric around the disk axis. In addition to the complex trough structure that you see, there's another constraint from polarization measurements. This is a broad absorption line QSO which shows three different troughs. Okay, and this is the flux. And for these two troughs, you see the fractional polarization rise in these two troughs, whereas in this trough here, you don't see any rise in fractional polarization. Okay? And so the interpretation in the context of this model is that you have some electron scattering region, which is fairly big, which encompasses absorption from these Okay. Well, I could talk. Okay, so I'm out of time. So let me just finish up by saying that the motivation for this particular model is that you actually require to have some covering at large radii in order to cover the electron scattering region, which provides the continuum polarization, which causes the rise in fractional polarization in these troughs. I don't actually have time to talk about everything I want to talk about now, so I'll just end there. Thank you very much. Could you repeat that again?
If you have the question of the line profile being stable over many years,
right?
And in that particular case, the fragile visible material, I think even optical depth stayed the same, right, over many years.
Right.
So if you have a quantum ejection of blob, like between the relation that you can see, you want to see the blob moves through the velocity.
Yeah, that's
even
right.
If the jet line stays fixed.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, sure. I think a more correct kind of observation would be if the velocity position of the graph do not change, but the actual optical depth change a lot. So it's a little different.
I did for the perpetuity variables where I discovered this instability for many blocks of the graph. Then I calculated the synthetic line profile and as a function of time. So I can see all kinds of results, but there are many things going on in the region. It is not really strongly reflected in the line profiles. We call it from the simulations. An illustration of a self-shielding I would argue that you may have a situation that you don't see just one of the blobs. It may be that one is being generated and accelerated before it goes away from the turn that produces another one. That may sound like a function
that gave rise to the magnetic model. You combine the problem and the acceleration of the flow. Can we do without the computer here now?
I think the point is that if you can filter out the ionizing photons, you don't need as high densities in the wind outflow in order to provide the absorption that you see. So you don't need confinement. You can have a smooth outflow with a filling factor of unity, essentially, for the absorption. So in that sense, yeah, you don't need the magnetic fields to confine them. Whether they're relevant for the acceleration is another issue.
Observational result that these things don't change on a long time scale. For some other reasons, one would think that the beam would be launched from much higher distances, which is a controversial issue. But if that's the case, you need something else than line driving to launch the beam from the disk. And then when it would launch and expose to the center, it would be an accelerator. So you separate two issues, launching and accelerating. So if you want to do that from large distances from the central point, I think MHB is the way to do it.
Sort of
Well, I mean, that's... Yeah, I mean, people have worked on MHD models, or at least included effects of magnetic fields in modeling these outflows. Dekul and Begelman had a model where, they had magnetic fields in the disk at very large radii, but the magnetic fields weren't dynamically important in terms of the acceleration. It was all radiative acceleration. Magnetic fields were just there to provide confinement. Okay, as I said, they have used the Blanchard and Payne mechanism in the context of broad emission lines in order to launch clouds of emission line emitting material from the surface of the disk. But I mean, in that case, they just used the self-similar solution of Blanchard and Payne, and they didn't do any detailed calculations of the MHD to determine what the effect would be on the outflow.
And if you're